Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
The Battle of Issus on November 1st, 333 BC, marked the first meeting on the field of honor between two kings, Alexander of Macedon and Darius III of Persia. It took place along a small river in what is today southwestern Turkey, on the narrow coastal plain between the Amanus Mountains and the Mediterranean Sea. The two armies faced each other on the banks of the river between the steep foothills and the Mediterranean. And there, on an autumn day, they made history. We might see the battle depicted in a mosaic from Pompeii. Originally decorating the floor of the House of the Faun, a luxurious villa in Pompeii, today the mosaic is found on the wall of a gallery in the National Archaeological Museum in Naples, in Italy. It's a fantastic work of art in one of the Mediterranean's greatest museums of antiquities, and I hope that you are lucky enough to visit it someday. I myself have been there quite a few times and have clocked in hours looking at it. If you do, here's what you'll see. A scene of Alexander, spear in hand, charging on horseback against Darius of Persia. Three Persian cavalrymen and a row of pikes are all that come between the two warrior kings. Driving ever forward with his horsemen riding beside him, Alexander is poised to kill Darius. The Persian is in danger and he knows it. He stands wide-eyed on his chariot, facing the enemy. But Darius's charioteer is ready. Having turned the horses away from Alexander, he pulls the reins and cracks a whip to spur a rapid escape. Frozen in time, the moment captures the climax of a dramatic clash of kings. To be honest, we don't know which of the two great battles between Alexander and Darius this mosaic represents. It might even be some stylized amalgam of the two battles, but we might imagine it as depicting a scene from the Battle of Issus. On that autumn afternoon, the Macedonian and Persian armies fought over the fate of empire. The Macedonians were a winning and experienced force, but the Persians had strengths too, and they outnumbered the Macedonians 2-1. A king led each. Alexander of Macedon faced Darius of Persia. Issus is known as a clash of kings and one that highlights Alexander's heroism. And that's no accident. Like the Kennedys or Britain's royal family, Alexander had a knack for public relations, and he highlighted his valor. In truth, Issus demanded other qualities. Not Alexander's heroism so much as his coolness, steadiness, and caution won the battle. I'll try to explain all that, but in order to understand what happened at Issus, we've got to get a grip both on the timing and on the geography. So let's start with the timing. In our last podcast, we left Alexander in May 334 BC, when he won his first great victory on the Granicus River in northwestern Turkey. After Granicus, the cities along Turkey's Aegean coast began opening their gates to Alexander and offering him food and tax money, both of which he badly needed. As he marched southward, he encountered resistance, first at the city of Miletus and then at Halicarnassus, both port cities, and Halicarnassus was Persia's major naval base in western Turkey. Alexander took Miletus easily, but at Halicarnassus he faced a very stiff resistance, and no wonder. The leader of the resistance was none other than Memnon of Rhodes. You remember Memnon. He was a brilliant Greek mercenary general who fought for Persia. He was one of Alexander's toughest opponents. For 2 months in summer 334 BC, Memnon successfully defended Halicarnassus. In the end, he had to surrender the town to Alexander, but not the harbor, which was fortified and remained in Persian hands. Alexander then marched inland and occupied much of central Turkey. In spring 333 BC, he headed south again. Meanwhile, Memnon had left Halicarnassus for the Aegean Islands. In spring 333, he launched a naval offensive with a massive fleet. His plan was to sweep through the islands and invade Greece, where anti-Macedonian forces would join him in a rebellion. Memnon's intention was to force Alexander to come back home to defend his control of Greece. Macedon itself might even have been at stake. Alexander had dismissed most of his ships out of concerns of disloyalty, and he had no way to stop the enemy. But Alexander turned out to be fortunate. In summer 333 BC, Memnon died suddenly, apparently of natural causes, perhaps of a heart attack or stroke. There were others who could have continued the offensive, but no other admiral enjoyed the confidence of the Persian king Darius as Memnon had. Darius decided to stop the naval offensive and to fight Alexander on land instead. Now, in my opinion, this was a strategic error. Persia's best hope against Alexander was to use their naval superiority to bring the war back home to Greece. But you know, as often in war, politics trumped military logic. From the political point of view, not the military point of view, but from the political point of view, it made sense for Darius to fight a land battle. Why? Because the Persians expected their king to fight heroically in battle. And so Darius made a fatal choice. He recalled the mercenaries accompanying the Persian fleet, and they took ship for the southern Turkish coast and left the Aegean Islands. The die was set for land geography. So now we've got the timing. Now let's think about the geography. Think of Turkey as an arm stretching westward into the Mediterranean Sea, with its territory extending downwards, that is, southwards, past the armpit and onto the ribs. The Battle of Issus took place along the side of those ribs. Darius was aware that Alexander was heading south and east from central Turkey. In fact, by summer 333, Alexander had reached Cilicia, the fertile and wealthy plain on Turkey's southern coast, just north and northeast of the island of Cyprus. Cilicia is the gateway to Syria. Darius did not want to risk allowing Alexander to enter into the heart of his empire, that is, into what is nowadays Iraq, ancient Mesopotamia. It was a wealthy and populous region. And so Darius chose to go west and to fight the enemy in Syria. When he made this decision, Darius had to act quickly. It meant that he did not have time to gather all of the empire's far-flung forces. In particular, Darius had to do without the great horsemen of Central Asia, but he would gather a strong army even so. By September, Darius and his soldiers were ready to march. October 333 saw them camped on the plains of Syria. To the west of them stood the Amanus Mountains, which reach a height of 7,350 feet. That is to say, about as high as the highest peak in the U.S. east of the Rocky Mountains. Beyond the Amanus Mountains lay Cilicia and the Macedonians. Alexander had surely heard of Darius' plans to come westwards, but even so, he was shocked to discover how close the enemy was. They were less than a week's march away over the mountains in Syria. Both armies wanted to fight, but in entirely different places. When it comes to planning a battle, the same rule applies as in buying a house. Location, location, location. Troops, training, and leadership all matter. But to no small extent, when it comes to fighting, where you are is how you do. The Persians wanted to fight on the wide plains of Syria because they could spread out there and make use of their superior numbers. Alexander hoped to fight in a narrow space between the mountains and the sea, where the Persians could not deploy their army comfortably. There was suitable terrain around Issus, a coastal city at the head of the Gulf of Issus, what we call today the Gulf of Iskenderun in Turkey. There, a coastal strip only several miles wide stretches from the Amanus Mountains to the Mediterranean. And in case you're interested, the Amanus Mountains is the ancient name. It's the name I'm using. Nowadays, they're known as the Nur Mountains. As it turned out, Alexander got to fight where he wanted, but not as he wanted. To understand how this happened, we have to look carefully at the pre-battle moves. We have to remember how limited military intelligence was in ancient times, and how difficult it was to carry out good scouting. Anyhow, here's how it played out. Encamped in the west, Alexander refused to take the bait and cross the mountains to head eastward for Syria and the Persians. So, either because he was impatient or because his army is running out of food, it was Darius who decided to move. He decided to go west. He decided to take his army across the mountains and to fight Alexander in Cilicia. Why Cilicia? Because this is a zone of broad coastal plains, and it would make an acceptable substitute for Darius's preferred battlefield in Syria. So Darius went west, and he entered Cilicia via a mountain pass called the Amanus Gates. Nowadays, it's Turkey's Bakche Pass. The Amanus Gates. Roughly, if you think of the map of Turkey, he entered it through the armpit. Darius wanted to head westward into the arm, if you will. But it was too late, because Alexander had already left. He was marching south past Issus and along the narrow Mediterranean coast towards Syria. That is, Alexander was marching along the ribs, to return to our metaphor. Darius now followed, which was good for Alexander, except for one problem. Alexander had expected Darius to march towards him from the south. After crossing the Amanus Range via a southern mountain pass, known in ancient times as the Syrian Gates. Today, it is Turkey's Belen Pass. In other words, Alexander expected Darius to enter the plain in the middle of the ribs, but Darius surprised Alexander by entering through the armpit. Darius surprised Alexander by coming from the north. When Darius reached the Mediterranean at Issus, he found himself in Alexander's rear, cutting off the Macedonians from their supplies, which were still further north yet. That was kind of a nice surprise for Darius, and it put his army in a strong position between the enemy and the enemy's supplies. But what a shock for Alexander! He was cut off. What to do? Well, a lesser general would have been nonplussed by Darius's unexpected arrival behind him. A lesser general would have panicked, but Alexander stayed relaxed. He was a cavalryman, after all, and cavalrymen are used to operating far from their home base. Still, he deserves a lot of credit for keeping cool and staying calm. The crisis brought out the best in the Macedonian king. When the news came, it was evening. After letting his men eat, Alexander turned his entire army around and marched them backwards towards the Persians, covering a distance of about 10 miles. They camped in a narrow zone, and at dawn the next morning they began marching about another 10 miles towards the Persians, and then they fanned out in battle order. So without breaking a sweat, Alexander had turned his army around rapidly and deployed it for battle. This was a major achievement, and we shouldn't pass it by without noticing it. As for Darius, he probably should have retreated to Cilicia and tried to draw Alexander back northward into the plain. But that's hindsight. Let's look at it from another point of view. Surprise is a force multiplier that dramatically increases an army's effectiveness. And maybe the Persians thought that they had caught Alexander off guard. Or perhaps, as one source says, it was too dangerous to retreat with Alexander ready for battle. And so the Persians stood and fought. Okay, now we've gone through the pre-battle moves, and I know they're a little confusing, but I hope that I shed some light even so. Let's turn to the lineup of forces. The two armies met on the Pinaris River. Here, according to the ancient sources, the plain was about 1.5 miles wide. The game of moves and misdirection had ended to Alexander's distinct advantage. Darius had wanted to fight on the plain, and Alexander had wanted to fight in the narrows, and Alexander won. At least the Persians could take comfort in one thing. Darius and his generals had chosen the best place to fight that they could within the narrow plain. As we'll see, they made their stand on a natural boundary. The steep-banked Pinaris River ran from the winding foothills of the Amanus Mountains to the Mediterranean, where it reached a level beach. But where precisely was the Panaris River? Scholars have debated the location. That's what we scholars do. The likeliest site is the small city of Pyas, Turkey, located on the Pyas River. Pyas sits about 12 miles north of the pretty port city of Iskenderun and about 50 miles north of the provincial capital of Antakya. Iskenderun is also known as Alexandretta, named after Alexander, and Antakya is the ancient Antioch, named after one of Alexander's successors. The Pyas River starts in the hills, and it flows around 40 miles into the Mediterranean Sea. I was able to visit Pyas and to see the battle site with my friend Serhan Güngör. Serhan is Turkey's super guide. There is no better companion for a tour of Istanbul or anywhere else in Turkey. You can find him on the web at serhangungur.com. That's S-E-R-H-A-N as in November, G-U-N as in November, G-O-R.com. Issus was one of the stops that Serhan and I took on our trip as we followed Alexander's footsteps in a wonderful tour from the Hellespont to Antioch, a distance of roughly 1,900 miles. As we inspected the Pyas River area, we noticed that the banks were steep in the foothills of the mountains, around the present-day Pyas iron and steel factory. The terrain would have been challenging to ancient armies. As you reach the coast, the elevation levels out and the river flows into a flat plain, perfect for cavalry action. Thanks to Serhan's knowledge of Turkish history, we realized another reason why most scholars cite the battle on the Pyas River and not elsewhere. The reason is that it is a natural boundary. Let me give you two relevant data points. One, in the early modern period, the Ottomans built in Pyas a caravanserai, that is, a roadside inn, where travelers could stop and rest and recover from the day's journey. This particular caravanserai was designed by the great Sinan, the leading architect in Ottoman history. You can visit it today, as we did, and this caravanserai is splendid. There's also a castle nearby. Second data point. In the 1920s and 30s, in the turmoil surrounding the emergence of modern Turkey, France occupied what is now the area south of Pyas, that is, Hatay province. The Pyas River was the border between the French zone and the Turkish zone. By the way, in a plebiscite held in 1939, the people of this region voted to join Turkey, and it's part of Turkey today. In short, earlier eras recognized the Pyas River as a natural stopping point. It makes complete sense that the Persian commanders, too, decided to stop and make a stand there and not elsewhere. Now, let's go back to that battle on the November day over 2,000 years ago. It's clear that Alexander was greatly outnumbered. An educated guess is that he had nearly 30,000 infantry and about 5,000 cavalry. Darius's forces were probably about 65,000 infantry, including 15,000 Greek mercenaries, and about 15,000 cavalry. So what we've got on the two sides is about 35,000 troops on the Macedonian side versus about 80,000 troops on the Persian side. So the Persians outnumbered the Macedonians by a bit more than 2-1. The Greek mercenaries in the Persian army were first rate, but the other Persian infantrymen were not. It's not as if they weren't brave or well-trained, but they simply didn't have the equipment or the unit cohesion or the experience that the Greek mercenaries did. They were, after all, professionals. Alexander, well, his comparative advantage in battle was quality, not quantity. Alexander positioned his troops on the south bank of the Panaris River. He arranged them in what would become his classic battle order. The Macedonian phalanx stood in the center of the line to tie down the Greek mercenaries opposite them. On the left wing, allied cavalry and light-armed troops took a defensive stance under the command of the veteran Macedonian general Parmenio. They were on the west, on the flat plain near the sea. In the east, on the steep ground in the foothills, stood the right wing of the Macedonians. This was the Macedonian striking arm, spearheaded by the elite troops known as the Companion Cavalry and led by Alexander himself. Their task was to look for an opening in the enemy line and pour through it. Alexander followed a simple strategy at Issus, decapitation. By tradition, the Persian king stood at or near the center of his battle line, behind a protective infantry force. At Issus, Darius stood closer to his left flank, that is, towards the foothills. Alexander aimed straight for Darius, hoping to overpower his guards, the weaker Persian infantry, not the Greek mercenaries, and to force the great king to run for his life. Alexander figured that when Darius's army heard that their leader had fled in fear, they would give up, even if they happened to be winning on their part of the battlefield. Alexander's greatest hope was to kill Darius. That would shake the Persian political system and might even cause its collapse. Darius took up a position on the steep northern bank of the Panaris River. It was good defensive ground, but he needed to go on offense. That was a job for the cavalry. The infantry would absorb the enemy's attack. The Persians posted their cavalry on the wings and their infantry in the center. Ideally, they would fight on a wide battlefield, but unfortunately for Darius, Issus was narrow. Had he fought on the plain, Darius would have enveloped the Macedonian army with the superior numbers of cavalry. But at Issus, the Mediterranean and the mountains protected the Macedonian flanks. Darius needed a new plan. He got one, proving himself a quick and creative thinker. Darius recognized two weaknesses in the Macedonian army, the phalanx in the Macedonian center and the allied cavalry on the Macedonian left wing. Darius was confident that his Greek mercenary phalanx could hold the Macedonian phalanx. But turning toward the sea, Darius wasn't sure that the cavalry on the Persian right wing could break through the enemy cavalry opposite on the Macedonian left wing. So Darius added power to his punch by transferring most of the cavalry on the Persian left wing to the Persian right wing, which he hoped would help the Persians break through the enemy line near the Mediterranean Sea. Unfortunately, that left the Persians' left wing, which stood near the foothills of the mountains, vulnerable. Darius tried to defend that wing by sending light-armed troops into the foothills, where they could circle around and take the enemy in the rear. Both moves looked promising, but Alexander parried them. He too proved up to the challenge of readjusting under pressure. Alexander placed archers and javelin men in the foothills on his right to deflect Darius's thrust. Then, just before the battle began, Alexander moved the best of his allied cavalry to his left wing, and he did so in secret by moving them behind his lines. So we have the two armies lined up on the two sides of the river. The Persians are facing south. The Macedonians are facing north. The lines stretch from the foothills of the mountains to the sea. And each army has adjusted its lineup in preparation for the battle. It probably took all morning to get the armies into position. And so the battle began in the afternoon. The two armies were already in sight of each other, but not yet in javelin range. The sources report that Alexander rode ahead of his front flags and called out his commanders by name to encourage them. No doubt the Persians did something similar. Then came two final moves to inspire the men. In both armies, the trumpeters signaled the attack, and the men shouted their battle cries. The roar echoed off the thickly wooded mountains. And as I stood in the foothills of the Amanus one summer day and looked up to those hills, I could imagine hearing the echo. Well, the battle confounded expectations. In the center, Darius's Greek mercenaries not only held off the Macedonian phalanx, they found gaps in it, and they made the Macedonians pay in blood. In the Macedonian left, towards the sea, Parmenio, Alexander's general, led a tough defense that kept the Persian cavalry from advancing. Darius's blow was stopped. Meanwhile, the Macedonians unleashed their own strike from their right wing, adjacent to the mountains, in the east. Alexander led his companion cavalry across the Panaris River, up the steep opposite bank, and into the Persian infantry. The sources disagree about whether they charged across or simply cantered.
Once they reached the Persians, the companion cavalry cut through them until Alexander was fighting in sight of Darius. And now there took place the famous confrontation of the two kings, with which this podcast began, the confrontation you can see in the mosaic in the museum in Naples, Italy. After realizing that his position was hopeless, Darius turned and fled. He was not a coward, but a realist. He understood that he had lost a battle, but he still could win the war, as long as he survived. As so often in ancient history, we have to depend on sources from the side of the winner. That is, we rely on histories written in Greek or Latin that sympathize with Alexander. We don't have a history written in ancient times that tells the story from the Persian point of view. But we do have a remarkable and useful document from medieval Iran. Although it was written over 1,000 years later, it is based on an oral tradition going back to ancient times. The document I'm referring to is the great poem of Ferdowsi, the Shahnameh, around 1000 AD. It's the national epic of Iran. Ferdowsi lived circa 940 to 1020 AD, and he is hugely influential in Iranian literature. Shahnameh means Book of Kings, and it's a poetic account of Iranian history. Ferdowsi tells us about three battles between, quote, Sikandar and, quote, Dara. Sikandar is our Alexander, Dara is our Darius. Now, this is poetry, not history, and it is impressionistic, not factual. Like the Alexander mosaic that we just talked about, it is more like a generic battle between Alexander and Darius than it is a particular historical account of a specific engagement. So, with all due caution, let's hear how the Iranian poet remembers the first great battle between the two kings. I'm going to read you from a prose translation. The sun rose over the mountains, and the land glowed like a golden lamp. Dara mustered the ranks of his army, which covered the earth like a pitch-black cloak. He led his men, more numerous than blades of grass, across the Euphrates. And when Sikandar heard of their approach, he had the war drum sounded and the troops prepared. The two hosts could not be counted, but in all the world there was only one Sikandar. Dust loomed over the scene like a mountain, and the whole plain seemed a seething sea of weapons and warriors, of armor and Indian daggers, of war horses and barding. On each side the troops were drawn up, and the sun flashed on their swords. In the vanguard were the war elephants, and behind them the cavalry, men who had renounced all love of life. The very air seemed to cry out for blood, the land to groan with the warriors' battle cries, the mountains to shake with the din of trumpets and Indian chimes. The horses neighing and the combatant shouts, the crashing of heavy maces on armor, all seemed to transform the plain to a mountain of warfare, and the air turned black with dust. For 7 days the battle raged, and on the eighth a dust storm obscured the sun and blew against the blinded Persians, who fled from the battlefield. Sikandar's men pursued them, the one host full of sorrow, the other of joy, back to the banks of the Euphrates, where innumerable Persians were killed. At first the Greek troops turned back from the river, but Sikandar ordered them across, and they entered the abandoned Persian camp in triumph. That's Ferdowsi. I'd like to thank, by the way, my former grad student, Jake Nabel, now a professor at Penn State, for introducing me to Ferdowsi. Jake does terrific work on East-West relations, and he's an expert in Iranian history, as well as in the history of Greece and Rome. So, gentle listeners, when teachers tell you that we learn from our students, we're not just being polite. We really do learn from them. Now, let's get back to the aftermath of the battle. Alexander passed another test. Despite the temptation to ride after Darius, Alexander was mature enough to put first things first. He now turned toward his center to help his phalanx. That turned the tide, and the Macedonians pushed the Greek mercenaries back. Alexander received a minor thigh wound in the fighting. Meanwhile, Parmenio and the allies in the Macedonian left launched a counterdrive against the Persian cavalry. Whether because of that thrust or because of the news of Darius' flight, the Persians turned and galloped off toward safety. But their own infantry blocked the way, and many men were trampled to death. Macedonian casualties were higher at Issus than at the Granicus. The sources, who probably underestimate, report 500 Macedonian deaths and 4,000 wounded. Persian losses were much, much higher, because an army that tries to run away, especially over rugged terrain, is bound to suffer. Still, no reliable Persian casualty figures exist. Issus turned out as it did for three reasons: pre-battle maneuvers, the skill of the Macedonian army, and the tactical wisdom of Alexander. No fool, Alexander knew how much he relied on his generals. Without the heroic defense on the left wing by Parmenio, for example, the Persians might have taken Alexander in the rear, and the result would have been a very different story. The Persians were far from incompetent. They fought well, but the Macedonians fought better. Darius had no mean organizational or tactical skills, and he was quick on his feet. But he lacked Alexander's self-confidence and single-mindedness, or Alexander's gifts as a battlefield commander. Besides, compared to Macedon's military machine, the Persian army was brittle and inexperienced. Issus was a great victory for Alexander, but it didn't decide the war. Darius survived, as did part of his army. He still controlled most of a vast empire, with huge military and financial resources at his disposal, including the Mediterranean's preeminent fleet. In fact, Alexander might have been frustrated with the Battle of Issus' outcome. He had come close to killing the one man who, more than any army, stood between him and control of an empire. But Darius had slipped away. Now Alexander would have to fight him again or negotiate with him. Still, the contest would not continue at the same level as before. Alexander had improved his position enormously. As an added bonus to battlefield victory, he captured money and very important people. Persian kings brought their family to the battlefield, probably as a sign of confidence. Forced to run for his life, Darius had left behind his mother, his principal wife, his daughters, and son, all of whom fell into Alexander's hands. They were now hostages. Alexander sent Parmenio rushing to Damascus, where he captured over 3,000 talents of gold and silver. That's about 170,000 pounds of gold and silver. He also captured additional hostages. One of those additional hostages was Barsini. Barsini was Memnon's widow. Eventually, she became Alexander's mistress, and the two of them even had a child, a son. If we were to continue the story of Alexander the Great, we would talk more about that, and we would certainly go on to Alexander's next and final great battle against Darius, this time at Gaugamela, in what is today Iraqi Kurdistan. But we will save that for another season. Instead, next time in this year's podcast series, we'll turn to the new power that rose in the West, to Rome. See you next time on Antiquitas. The translation of Ferdowsi Shahnameh that I read comes from Dick Davis's 2007 translation, Shahnameh, the Persian Book of Kings. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review.
Theme music by Lush Life.